We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In this hour of focus, we'll be talking with Terence Ranger. He's a well-known historian of Africa who has in his work focused on the history of Zimbabwe, both its history when it still was Rhodesia and a colony, and also its post-colonial history. He's an emeritus fellow of St. Anthony's College, Oxford, and at the moment is visiting George A. Miller visiting professor at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. And he will be giving a talk about Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, and about the ways that people think about its history. He'll be giving a talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the campus. This is at the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in the Knight Auditorium. This is an event in the MillerCom series, as sponsored by, in part, the Department of History and International Programs and Studies. And these programs, these talks, are always open to anyone who is interested in hearing them. So it's free, and you should feel welcome to stop by if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana. And as we talk, we welcome input from people who are listening. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Email also is possible at will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point, you're certainly welcome to call.
I think I'd better say that the lecture is tomorrow, Thursday.
Oh, my apologies. You're absolutely correct. And in fact, I have a flyer for it right in front of me. And yes, sir, indeed, it is tomorrow, Thursday, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The other parts I got right.
You did, yes.
That part. Well, thank you very much for being here. We certainly appreciate it. It's interesting, the pairings of the two programs that we've had this morning, actually, if people will permit me to digress, because in the first hour, we were talking with a psychologist who's done research on memory. Mm-hmm. And a main point of his research is that in spite of the fact that people perhaps think that their memories are recordings of things that happened, he says memory is something that is constructed. And it seems to me that you're very interested in how it is in this particular place in Zimbabwe, people have thought about and written about the country's history, particularly the struggle for independence and what has happened afterwards, and how many different ways people have constructed that history. And I wonder to what extent, in fact, people are constructing a memory, and that different people are going to have different, almost in a way, are going to have different memories of what happened.
Yes, that's very true. Zimbabwe is a country good for a historian to be in because history is so important to Zimbabweans and they're passionate about it. When I first went to what was then Rhodesia in 1957, the settler government was putting advertisements in the African press saying, in effect, Africans have no history. Africans didn't build Great Zimbabwe. There's no history. And Africans were tremendously frustrated at being a people without a history, with nothing in the textbooks and the school books and so on. And now, after independence, the government of Robert Mugabe bases its claim to legitimacy on a version of history, which in turn is being contested by the opposition. So Zimbabwe is a country where history matters a very great deal. Unlike South Africa, where history doesn't matter a very great deal, and where the claim to legitimacy rests upon the Freedom Charter and so on. But in Zimbabwe, your version of history is absolutely crucial.
I think, in fact, I read something that you had written where there's a line, and I won't be quoting it exactly, but something to the effect that politics matters more to history in Zimbabwe than any other country in Southern Africa?
Yes, and I might have turned that round and said history matters more to politics in Zimbabwe than any other country in Southern Africa. It's a very historically conscious place. In fact, before I went to Rhodesia, before I went to Africa, I had been working on the history of Ireland in the 17th century. And Ireland's the only other place that I can think of where history was so contentious and so important. It's somewhat similar, the hotness of history in Zimbabwe.
What led you to switch from studying history of Ireland to history of Africa?
Well, in fact, just going there, I decided that I wanted eventually to end up working in Oxford, but that I'd like to have an adventure before I did that. And I applied to the university, the new university in what was then Salisbury. I applied to it on a misapprehension, not exactly on false pretenses, but I saw an advertisement in the Times newspaper saying it represented a new kind of ideology. It was neither the white nationalism of South Africa nor the black nationalism of the North, but that the university represented the ideology of multiracialism and partnership. And that's why I went to it. It seemed to me to be an admirable place in which one might make a contribution. But it turned out that that was an erroneous impression, because the university was in the most segregated city in Southern Africa, more so than South African cities. Salisbury was completely segregated, and even at the university itself, the halls of residence were segregated. So that the university didn't turn out to be a beacon of partnership. And I very rapidly became disillusioned with that idea.
And did you have the opportunity, or did you just try to take the opportunity to talk with people who had that kind of orientation that you had gone there thinking that you were going to find?
Yes, there were some politicians who represented that aspiration, both so-called moderate black politicians and some so-called liberal white politicians. But the university had been a compromise. White Rhodesians wanted a university of their own. Up until then, their children had gone to South Africa. And they were prepared to allow African students to come to it, providing that there was segregation in the residences and providing that the entry standard was very high. So the entry standard was too high for all but a mere handful of Africans. I think we had 10 African students who were the only ones who had been able in the whole of the Federation to reach that level of entry. So I was dealing with a very disgruntled minority of black students, and I came to know them very well because I was appointed as warden of the halls of residence, and that took me away from interacting with the local white community and meant that I was interacting very intensely with black intellectuals and their friends and families.
Did those people then go on to have a significant role in Zimbabwe in post-colonial Rhodesia?
Yes. For example, one of them, Simpson Mutambinengwe, is now the head of the Electoral Commission in Zimbabwe, having been a very distinguished judge in Namibia for some years. And Simpson was the most engaging student of whom I became very fond in that early period that we're talking about. There was one African female student, Sarah Chabanduka, whose position was particularly difficult because they had a hall of residence for white men, a hall of residence for white women, a hall of residence for black men, but nothing for a black woman. So Sarah was there with nowhere to stay. She stayed in my house for a period until the principal thought that that was not proper. And so Sarah became the body over whom the whole battle of integration was fought. Mm-hmm. Since then, she's had a distinguished career. She also was a member of the last electoral commission. She's been the top civil servant in several ministries. What happened was that there were students there at the time that I was teaching from the two northern territories that became Zambia and Malawi, and so they fairly rapidly rose to the top. But the liberation struggle in Zimbabwe lasted much longer, so it wasn't for another 20 years or more that these Zimbabwean students found themselves in that kind of position. Mm. But since then, they have all become important in the new state.
What were the circumstances in the early 60s and under which you were invited to leave the country?
When I look back in it, I'm not surprised. I always say I was deported, but strictly speaking, that wasn't true. Because had they used the deportation legislation, they would have had to explain why I was being deported. So what they did instead was to declare me a prohibited immigrant, which you could really only properly do on entry to the country. I had been living there for 6 years, but nevertheless, they declared me a prohibited immigrant, and then they didn't have to explain why they were doing it. So no explanation was ever given, but there had been constant calls for my deportation and expulsion. I had become very, very unpopular with the Rhodesian white community. And it's hard to say which of the many things I did irritated people the most. I had become a member of the African Nationalist Party. I ran a sort of Martin Luther King sitting campaign at restaurants and theatres because, as I told you earlier, Salisbury was the most segregated city. And that, I think, irritated people a very great deal. I was editing a magazine of criticism called Dissent. So there were many, many reasons why they wanted to get rid of me.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Terence Ranger. He is a leading historian of Africa, particularly interested in the history of Zimbabwe. He is an emeritus fellow of St. Anthony's College, Oxford, and is now a George A. Miller visiting professor at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. We'll be talking about Rhodesia in Zimbabwe in a talk tomorrow, Thursday, the 14th, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. This is at the Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory. It's a MillerCom event. Anyone interested should feel welcome to stop by. Our show here is also open to comments, questions, people who want to get into the conversation. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. So after that point, then, when was the first time that you were back after having been booted out?
Well, it took longer than I had thought. On the day that I was having to leave the country, I gave a kind of Douglas MacArthur statement. Sir Edgar Whitehead has gone, Sir Roy Lindsay is going, but as for me, I shall return. Which sounded grand, but it took me a long time to return. I wasn't able to return. This was in 1963 that I was being kicked out. And I wasn't able to return for 17 years until 1980 at the coming of independence. What I did was that, having arrived in Rhodesia as a historian of Ireland in the 17th century, I left it after 6 years as a historian of Africa, and I went to Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, where I became professor of history. I spent 6 years in Dar es Salaam. And then from there I went to UCLA and was professor of African history. So by that time I had thoroughly become an Africanist. And I was able to return to Zimbabwe in 1980 and thereafter do a lot more research in Zimbabwe and to write many more books about it.
Well, when you came back that first time, were you thinking that or hoping that perhaps the kind of approach, the kind of place that you were looking for when you first went there, that maybe this time that's what you would find?
Yes. What happened was that, advised by other African leaders, particularly Kenneth Kaunda of Zambia and Samora Machel of Mozambique, they told Mugabe that he ought not to frighten away the white technicians and entrepreneurs upon whom the economy depended. So although white Rhodesians were terrified of Mugabe, he astounded them in his first speeches by offering a policy of reconciliation, saying somewhat sinisterly, "You cannot escape our love." So there was a situation where he was actually calling for a common Zimbabwean citizenship in which whites would participate. And as so often in Zimbabwe, there was an amnesty for offences that had been committed by both sides during the guerrilla war. So the message of those first two or three years was that we're wiping the slate clean, and we're inviting you now to participate in a new nation. So in a way, that was very encouraging, because it was a new nation. A lot of foreign aid was coming in, and the education system was being rapidly built up, and the health system was being rapidly built up. And in those first 10 years, there was a great increase in age expectation and literacy and so forth. Unfortunately, at the same time, there was a lot of violence in the west of the country, where a different party had strength, and Mugabe was determined to break that and move towards a one-party state. So one has to say, except for Matabeleland, those first 10 years were good. But that violence, as I gradually reluctantly came to know about it, was horrifying, and subsequently I've written a book about it in order to punish myself for not knowing about it while it was going on. But nevertheless, in many parts of the country, those were years of achievement. I've heard Mugabe in 2002 in the presidential election campaign apologize to his audiences. And what he was apologizing for was not the violence that had been used in Matabeleland, but the offer of reconciliation to whites. "I'll never do this again," he said. "I meant it seriously. They didn't take it seriously." And there's some truth in what he says, because having recovered from their fear, the whites felt, well, we'll just go on, you know, as we always have. They didn't make any attempt to offer bits of land to African farmers and so on. They just enjoyed the return of a strong economy and offered very little collaboration to the new state. And so eventually Mugabe became impatient, and his rhetoric now is very anti-white, very racist, really.
And his, and the, just to round things out, people perhaps do know indeed that the country, it is said that the country is suffering greatly as a result of his policies, the fact that it is a one-party state. His party, ZANU-PF, is the dominant party, and anyone who is not allied with his party is persona non grata. So it doesn't matter if you're black or you're white, or if you're one of his opponents, then things will not go well for you.
Yes, in the last 2 years, 3 years, it's been a bit more complicated than that, because he actually lost a parliamentary election in March 2008. And then, with the use of a great deal of violence, won the presidential election in June. And the result of that is that there's, in fact, a sort of coalition government, a government of national unity, they call it, where Mugabe is theoretically balanced by a prime minister who is leader of the opposition party, Morgan Tsvangirai. So it isn't a one-party state, certainly, but on the other hand, Mugabe has retained control over what matters to him, namely the army, the police, security, and so forth. Mm. And he and his ministers tend to take the line, "We aren't sharing government, we're sharing administration. Let the MDC administer things, but we have the power." And there's a real sense in which that's true. That started off in something of the same way 2 or 3 years ago, where there was actually an attempt to stop the hate speech and to have another reconciliation. But that's broken down now, and the state newspapers are full of hate attacks on the other party in the government of national unity. Mugabe said the other day, We, that is to say, his party, ZANU-PF, we represent the positive revolutionary forces, and the MDC represent the interests of imperialism. But he says it's like a battery. You have to have a positive and a negative, so maybe it's going to work.
Well, that indeed, certainly one of my questions was to the extent to which this bringing of the movement for democratic change and its leader, Mr. Tsvangirai, into government, whether to just what exactly that means, how much power the MDC and Mr. Tsvangirai actually have, and to what extent is it multi-party in name only.
Well, that's an absolutely key question, particularly in Britain at the moment. In Britain, we have thousands, maybe even millions, of Zimbabweans seeking asylum. And the Home Office, which is committed to cutting the numbers of people to whom it grants asylum, are arguing that things have changed very much for the better in Zimbabwe and that they can all now be safely sent back. And I act as a so-called expert witness on these matters. In a couple of weeks' time, there's a hearing in the asylum court. In a way, fortunately for those of us who are arguing against the Home Office position, Tsvangirai has recently, last week, broken out, so to speak, and denounced the current arrangements, accused Mugabe of not even attempting to collaborate, has said that the MDC will no longer recognize the people that Mugabe has unilaterally appointed. So the whole thing is under very great strain. Mm-hmm. They're both talking about going into elections, but that's bound to create another cycle of violence, so it's very difficult to see what's going to happen.
We have a couple of callers to bring into the conversation, so let's do that. Champaign County, here where we are, that's the first caller, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I don't want this to be reduced to mouthing some things that Mugabe says, but I'd like to return to history and ask you about the Lancaster House of Courts. And the way I remember it was that, there was promise there, and you talked about an era of some promise and some aid. But that the Lancaster Accord was negotiated in the last of Carter's administration. Correct me if I'm wrong on the timeline. And the ascendancy of Reagan and Thatcher in 80, actually Thatcher a little earlier, but basically scotched that entirely, if I recall. And Mugabe could be criticized even, or is criticized, for not being more persistent in insisting on some of the land reform support that was supposed to come forth, and that instead of going ahead with this, there was so-called constructive engagement for Reagan with the merciless apartheid regime, the covert actions, covert wars in the frontline states, and all of the misery of supporting Savindi and Mobutu. And so it seems to me that the U.S. and the Western role, quote-unquote, the North, has to be looked at in very critical terms, and it's easy to sort of ignore that part of the memory and the framework of and I'd just like for you to react to that and maybe straighten me out on the timeline if I got some of that wrong.
Now, sure, I think you're right. It's a very controversial issue, what was actually promised at Lancaster House. The Zimbabweans say that the British and the Americans promised that they would set up an international fund for the purchase of land. And a few months ago, there was a parliamentary inquiry in Britain into what promises were made. And it seems to have been much more of a nudge-nudge, wink-wink kind of situation. In the event, what happened was that only Britain made money available for purchase of land, because other nations from outside didn't want to be seen to devote their aid to Zimbabwe, largely to compensate white farmers. So they gave money to schools and to hospitals and so on, and Britain gave money for the acquisition of land. And there was an initial land reform scheme in the early 1980s, which was actually quite successful, but on too small a scale. You're right in saying that Mugabe can be criticized for then dropping the issue for a long time and not persisting with further pressure on Britain or the world for more funding for the acquisition of land. The Lancaster House Constitution entrenched property rights and said that it had to be on a willing seller, willing buyer basis. But, of course, the land that people were willing to sell was peripheral land, and there was no attempt made by white farmers to, at that point, to break up their bigger estates and to bring Africans in on them. Now, they say, the white farmers have always been in favour of land reform, but don't you believe it? They spent a lot of time trying to hold on to their huge estates, which gave rise to the wave of popular occupations and so on at the end of the 1990s. So, yes, you're right, it was a very imperfect settlement. But the criticism that's made by Mugabe is not so much of Lancaster House, not so much of the Conservatives, even, of John Major. In fact, Zimbabwe is the only country in which John Major is popular, I think. His criticism is of the Blair government and its reinterpretation that colonialism was over, Britain had no inherited colonial responsibilities. And you may have heard of the infamous Claire Short letter where she wrote saying, "We're not a colonial government. I am Irish, for God's sake. How can I be a colonialist?" And so they didn't recognise any obligations, even those that had been made at Lancaster House. So in Zimbabwe, what's said is that Blair and his New Labour betrayed the undertakings that had been given. And it's true that the New Labour government conducted itself in a way that made Mugabe's accusations seem correct. For example, they offered every white who wanted to leave Zimbabwe asylum in Britain, but they're trying very, very hard not to give blacks asylum. So the racist attitude towards it, the concern with white farmers and so on, is very, very strongly there.
I hadn't heard of the Claire Short letter, and it's, of course, true that if you're just because you're colonized doesn't mean you can't participate in the colonization of somewhere else. So, but it seems to me that the Reagan-Thatcher era and the wars and, that really set the tone for the aftermath of the independence has to be weighed in too, and I didn't hear you say anything about that. The Blair
government. Well, you're right that an element. I talked about the violence in that Abeliland, which was terrible violence. The Mugabe government attributed that violence to destabilization, to South African destabilization, such as was also going on in Mozambique. And it's true that the South Africans did try to intervene and to destabilize. What happened was that some of the senior intelligence officers, white intelligence officers who were being employed by the new Mugabe government, turned out to be working for South Africa and feeding false information to make the Mugabe government feel that there was a conspiracy against them in Matabeleland. But the South Africans really failed to destabilize because the chaps that they sent in were dealt with by Nkomo's supporters on the ground. So it was very much more a war between Zimbabweans than a destabilization exercise. But still, there it was, and you probably know that the Zimbabwean army was involved in the fighting in Mozambique against RENAMO. So it was part of this whole embattled situation that followed on. But it was a very strange situation. What has happened now with the... we began by talking about history. What's happened now with the historical rhetoric of the Mugabe government is that they never talk about Rhodesians. Everything is British now. And they've almost wiped out of memory the fact that in 1980 there was a British governor, Lord Soames, who was invited to stay on by Mugabe. the fact that there were British policemen at the polls in the 1980 elections, because in theory, after all, Ian Smith was in revolt against the British Crown. So the British were involved at that point in the administration of the transition of power. But the history has been smoothed out so that colonialism in Rhodesia is thought of as British colonialism directly, rather than as settler colonialism.
And maybe just very quickly, and I have another caller here I want to get to, but very quickly, for people who have not followed this history, it's just important to know that one of the big issues, maybe it was the biggest, at independence was the fact that the vast majority of the land in the country was held by whites.
Absolutely.
And the question is, well, could some – what do you do about that? How do you redistribute land? And that's to – I suppose to this day, that's still a big problem.
Yes, it's certainly not true any longer, although you see it's still being said. It's certainly not true any longer that the majority of land in the country is held by whites. There are now very few white landowners as a result of the forfeitures of the last period. So they've moved from the commercial willing seller, willing buyer, which was in the Lancaster House Constitution, to forfeiture of land. So there's been a transfer of land from whites to blacks, but it hasn't been funded adequately so that the new farmers who are on the land don't have money for fertilizers and plows and so on. It needs a massive investment by international financial authorities to carry through a smallholding land reform. I'm a great advocate of smallholding peasant production, but at the moment in Zimbabwe, the people who've been put onto this land really don't have very little chance. They have far away from markets, they don't have access to fertilizers or labor. And so, without doubt, agricultural production has gone down, not because commercial farming is necessarily the most efficient, but just because they haven't got adequate support to run an alternative system.
Hmm. Well, and is it not also the case that a lot of this land ended up going to Mr. Mugabe's supporters?
Yes, and they're doing a land audit. So we shall discover how much that's true. There's a tremendous lot of academic activity going on in Zimbabwe at the moment where detailed case studies are being made of particular areas of the country to see what has happened in terms of land occupation and production. Mm. And it's a very, very variegated position. In some areas it seems to have gone successfully. In other areas it's a complete mess. So it'll be some time before we can see what the fallout of all this is going to be.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Terence Ranger. He's a leading historian of Africa. He's emeritus fellow of St. Anthony's College, Oxford. At the moment, he is George A. Miller visiting professor at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. His special area of interest is the history of Zimbabwe. And he'll be talking about that in a MillerCom event tomorrow afternoon on the campus at 4. This is at the Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum, open to anybody who is interested, sponsored by the Department of History, International Programs and Studies, with a lot of help from a lot of other people, and including the Center for Advanced Study. And if you have questions, you're certainly welcome to call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here is another caller in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. I wonder if you would say a little something about the pre-colonial history of Zimbabwe. I believe it was the site of a late medieval empire of some importance, wasn't it?
Yes. As I said at the beginning, when I arrived in Rhodesia, as it then was in 1957, the government was putting advertisements in the African press denying that Africans could possibly have built Great Zimbabwe, which is the most impressive remains of a medieval civilization. Whites were committed to the view that it was much more ancient than that, and had been built by non-African peoples. The Queen of Sheba was a favored candidate for that. Meanwhile, archaeologists at that time were demonstrating that it clearly was medieval and it clearly was built by Africans. And that's why the country has been called Zimbabwe, with reference to those stone ruins. So it's very important symbolically that they exist. So it's thought of as having been the focal point of a powerful state, one of a number of powerful states, because just over the border in South Africa you have a place called Mapungubwe, which is another stone set of edifices slightly earlier than Great Zimbabwe. And then you have a warren of stone walls in western Zimbabwe at a place called Kami. So these now ruins are associated by archaeologists and historians with a series of successor states. And then, of course, the Portuguese came up the Zambezi and recorded their interactions with the great state of Mutapa, which didn't lead the same kind of stone ruins, but which was a very elaborate bureaucracy, very elaborate kingdom. And so that the African history of Zimbabwe has tended to take the form of people writing about those successive states, or empires, as they like to call them. The most recent Zimbabwean historians of that period, though, and one of them is in fact here at the moment visiting for these events, the most recent historians tend to take the view that too much attention has been paid to these so-called states, and they tend to take the view that they were never anything more than a system of overrule, and that the more important units were the smaller ones of the chieftaincies and so forth. But a great deal of work is being done now on Zimbabwean pre-colonial history. There's more written material than you might suppose because of the Portuguese interactions and the collection and interpretation of oral tradition has become more and more sophisticated. So we are beginning to get a much more effective notion of what happened in that past. There's recently been published, about 6 months ago, the first single-volume history of Zimbabwe, the first ever, called Becoming Zimbabwe. And it opens with a chapter on the pre-colonial period, where poor Gerald Masariri has to deal with 2,000 years in a single chapter, which he does very well. There are a lot of Zimbabwean archaeologists, so we are beginning to discover much more about that pre-colonial past than certainly one had any idea of in the 1950s when I arrived.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, will-talk@illinois.edu. That's our email. About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus, talking with historian Terrence Ranger. We talked right at the beginning about how in Zimbabwe, perhaps more than other places of than in Southern Africa, history and politics are all tangled up together. And certainly in the early on in the post-colonial period, historians were influenced by nationalism. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in having you talk about patriotic history and again about the way that Mr. Mugabe and his regime have been engaged in writing history and what the aim of patriotic history is.
Yes, I've written a piece about patriotic history and argued that it's different from, even though a development out of, nationalist history. It's not so much that it's been written about in books, but talked about in speeches and very much portrayed on television. I think it's important to realize that now there are a number of different newspapers in Zimbabwe, but that the Mugabe part of government still totally controls both television and radio. And so those are the two main instruments for the propagation of their view of the history, which is done in all kinds of ways, through film, through jingles, through discussion programs, and so on. And patriotic history, as I've called it, is a version of the past which sees it in terms of a series of revolutionary struggles, and which divides the past up into heroes and traitors. In fact, ZANU PF, Mugabe's party, has published a booklet which lists the names of Zimbabwean heroes and the names of traitors going right back over 200 years. So you go back to the 19th century and there's a list of who was a hero and who was a traitor, and through to the present day. So many of the members of the present government of national unity are listed in that book as traitors rather than heroes. And there's a great debate that goes on regularly, because what has been created is a place called Heroes Acre, where when they die, people who were important in the guerrilla war, but also many other people who have been supporters of Mugabe, are buried. And Mugabe's party has the monopoly, and he himself has recently said that only members of his party can be buried in Heroes Acre. So that the other part of this government of national unity tends to boycott the ceremonies at Heroes Acre. Then they're accused of disloyalty and lack of patriotism, sacrilege, and so forth. So there's a struggle over these symbols of the memory of the past. And the problem with patriotic history is that there were struggles and there were heroes, but it leaves out so many other things. For example, it leaves out trade unionism and strikes and the towns. It focuses entirely on this sequence of uprisings. So that this single volume, History of Zimbabwe, that I talked about, is trying to give a much broader, wider interpretation of the nation's past. There's a sort of debate between this very narrow, focused patriotic history on the one hand and a more widely based history on the other.
Mm. One aspect of the talk that you're going to get, I'm intrigued about this. I'm not exactly even sure how to formulate the question, but it has to do with the landscape, the land, and how that influences the way people think, maybe how it influences the way people particularly think about the past.
Yes, I've written a book about a particular landscape. The book is called Voices from the Rocks, and the landscape of the Metopos Mountains in the southwest of the country, where there are cave shrines from which you can still hear the voice of God speak. And when they were deciding what to call the new nation, as I said before, the majority decided they would call it Zimbabwe. But there was a strong minority that wanted to call it Matopo, because they said this was the most sacred landscape in Zimbabwe, and that the leaders of the nation would be able to go to the caves in the mountains and receive the approbation or disapprobation of God himself. It's an uncanny experience to hear the voice of God coming out of the cave. When the World Council of Churches met in Harare, I suggested they might like to go and hear the voice of God, but they thought that might be rather frightening.
Have you've been there?
Yes, I have.
Tell me about this experience.
Well, what happens is you're not allowed actually into the cave. You go to the access to the cave, and there's a sort of screen of poles. And in the interior recesses of the cave, there's an old woman, a postmenopausal woman, who's possessed. There are pools in the cave. It's like a Delphi or something of that sort. And the old woman speaks in very archaic Chirotri, and the priests outside interpret the questions to her and the answers that she gives to the people. So you hear the voice coming from the recesses of the cave, and these interpretations are then given to the people. And these caves have played a very important political role. They did very much in the 1980s when Dr. Nkomo's party was under so much pressure, and Nkomo would go to the caves and seek for the approbation of God in that kind of way. That really is a sacred landscape. And the caves, as well as the other things that they do, instruct people how to use that landscape, what trees you can cut down and what trees you can't cut down, where you can cultivate and so on. And there are many other parts of Zimbabwe where, in a less dramatic way, the same thing is true. Hmm.
I'm sure it was ever thus, though, in a situation like that, gives an extraordinary amount of power and influence to whoever it is who gets to do the interpreting.
That's true. Priests always try to keep mediums under control. What becomes splendidly unpredictable is when the voice escapes from the interpreter, which sometimes happens.
We're coming down to maybe about 3 or 4 minutes. I guess I'd like to give you the opportunity to talk about what history does, what it's about. I'm stating this kind of awkwardly, but I guess I'm trying to get at the idea that on the one hand, people say, well, history, really, it's about the past. It's about back there. And of course, history is also a lot about now, the way in which people try to, to bend the past to fit the needs of the now.
Yeah. Well, one of the intellectuals who is a supporter of Mugabe, Professor Mahoso, contrasts Mugabe's what he calls organic history with what he calls Western history, which breaks it up into phases and thinks that the past is over, whereas Mugabe knows that it's not. The past is continuous and repetitive and so on. And so Mahoso would say that the traditions of resistance and prophecy are not things that have passed, but they're still very much there in the present. So that when, for example, people say, how can these be war veterans? They're too young to have fought in the war. Mahoso will say that they are part of the same, their genes are the same, so to speak. Mm. So he has this great doctrine of the continuity of history, which I think is an interesting set of propositions. When I went back to teach at the University of Zimbabwe after I retired from my Oxford chair, and when I finally left the University of Zimbabwe again in 2001, I gave a farewell lecture called History Matters. You hardly need to tell you that in Zimbabwe because it so obviously does matter. But the question is, though, whether you can make a history matter which is more complicated and less revolutionary and less streamlined and so on than patriotic history. How can you write a plural history which has room for everybody and which is at the same time exciting? And that's the great dilemma, and that's what this new single-volume History of Zimbabwe is trying to do. I was encouraged that the man reviewing it in the Mail and Guardian, a black South African, had only one criticism of the book, which was that it was too short. That's not what academics and historians usually get told. So that was encouraging.
Well, it also, what you were saying, I guess, makes me think about maybe the problem for revolutions and revolutionaries is when do you decide that the revolution is over?
Absolutely.
And that revolutionaries, I think, probably as far as they're concerned, the revolution really is never over. It's not really quite in their interest for the revolution ever to be over.
No, the doctrine of continuous revolution, sure.
Yeah. What happens when Mr. Mugabe is gone?
It's really the question which is worrying very large numbers of people. Now that I've entered my own 80s, I can't help but have a certain admiration for Mugabe as an example of an active octogenarian but he can't go on forever. And the trouble is that there are no succession arrangements made. There are formal constitutional ones, but if he died, particularly if he were to die violently, which I certainly hope doesn't happen, if he died violently, there'd be a bloodbath. But even if he dies naturally, there's going to be a tremendous power struggle within his own party, let alone with other parties. So his death is really, his life is not the answer, but his death is not the answer either, unless he decides to himself to preside over a transition so that one knows at least who's supposed to inherit. At the moment, the greatest infighting is between factions of his own party who are manoeuvring for the succession rather than between them and the opposition. So Bishop Pius Nubé of Bulawayo used to pray publicly for Mugabe's death. And God didn't hear him, evidently. But it wouldn't be a good thing now unless people were much better prepared for it than they are.
Well, at that, we're going to have to stop. We're here at the end of our time for this conversation. But I do want to say again that our guest, Terrence Ranger, will be talking about Zimbabwe. The talk is titled From Spirit to Body, Approaches to Violence and Memory in Zimbabwe. It's an event in the Millercom series and will take place tomorrow, Thursday afternoon, 4 o'clock at the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum on the campus. These events are free and open to the public. Anybody who would like to stop by is welcome. Our guest, Terrence Ranger, is an Emeritus Fellow of St. Anthony's College, Oxford, and is now a George A. Miller Visiting Professor here at the University of Illinois. And we want to say to you, Professor Ranger, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.